Welcome to the Toastmasters podcast, the official podcast of Toastmasters International. Hello, everybody. This is Greg Gazin. Now, off the bat, one may not think that skills and life skills can be learned from professions unlike our own. Like training to be a pilot, what can we learn from that other than flying and landing a plane? You might just be pleasantly surprised. Our guest today is Phil Wilkes. He'll enlighten us on how lessons from the flight deck can be useful to everyone and anyone down on the ground. Phil is driven by passion for all things human performance. His road has taken him on a path to being an amateur race car champion, skiing instructor, hockey coach, pilot, and is currently an airline pilot trainer. He is the co-author of Performance Pilot, an Amazon bestseller exploring performance principles in aviation. His journey into public speaking through Toastmasters ultimately inspired his podcast, Like a Pilot, where he explores how the soft skills of pilots apply beyond the flight deck. Phil's insights into learning and training have led to articles, podcast appearances, and speaking engagements beyond aviation, including investing and motor racing. Phil joined Hawthorne Toastmasters in the middle of COVID in January 2021. During his term last year as president, led his club to President's Distinguished Status, its 16th such achievement in 17 years. His article, A Pilot's Perspective on Public Speaking, subtitled Taking My Lessons in Aviation from the Flight Deck to the Lectern, was featured in the My Turn section in the July 2024 issue of the Toastmaster magazine. Phil lives in Melbourne, Australia, but he's coming to us today from the beautiful harbor in Sydney, Australia. Phil Wilkes, welcome to the Toastmasters podcast.
Thanks, Greg. I think I'll have to get you to do all my introductions when I enter a room from now on. That was fabulous.
Taking lessons in aviation from flight deck to the lectern, I thought was absolutely brilliant. And when I initially read the bio you had sent me, race car driver, skier, pilot, all of a sudden I'm thinking of the original Top Gun movie when Tom Cruise says, "I feel the need. I feel the need for speed." So Phil, to kick us off, can you share a little bit about your background as a pilot and what led you to become a flying instructor for airline pilots?
Yeah, sure. So like so many pilots, in fact, I'd say most pilots, as long as I can remember, I've always wanted to be a pilot. Specifically when I was little, it was a military pilot. I started to learn to fly while I was still at school, which is once again what many pilots do. But I eventually did do what I wanted to do and joined the Air Force. I didn't get to fly fighters or anything exciting like that, just boring old transport aircraft. And it ended up my career working for a little while in officer training and then at our Air Force museum. At that time, when I left the Air Force, there weren't a lot of airline jobs going. So had an opportunity to go out and work in a variety of flying jobs as an instructor, flying miners to mine sites, night freight, and then worked my way through the airline system in regional airlines, domestic, international. As far as getting into the instructing side of things, I guess if I think way back, I was first exposed to instructional technique when I was a teenager and joined the Air Force cadets. This really inspirational trainer, John Sedenry, who did all of our instructional technique training. And I think like just about everyone on that course that I did, as I sat in his classes, it just inspired us all to train. I think everyone that I know on that course has gone on to train in some respect. I guess over the years, I've come therefore to believe that if you really want to master something, then you should teach it. And since a teenager, I guess you'd say I've grabbed every opportunity to do that. Like the things you're saying, I taught cadets, I coached junior hockey, I've worked as a driver coach and ski instructor, and of course now a flying instructor. So I think I've been training in the airline environment for around a decade now, and I just love it. I just love the instructing side of things.
Yeah, if you want to learn, you teach it. Obviously, in your work experience, you're exposed to public speaking. What was it that inspired you to join Toastmasters, and how did it change your approach to communication?
Because I'd written a book for pilots that you mentioned, I ended up being invited onto a couple of podcasts, and I think, once again, you mentioned again, one for race drivers, one for investors. It makes total sense, right? Totally related to flying. But after I was on the investors podcast, one of my friends, he's an IT professional, Brenton, he rang me up and he said he'd listened to it and he asked if he could forward my name for consideration as a keynote at an IT conference. But at the time, I'd never even been to a conference, so the whole thought of standing up in front of a lot of people and speaking was something I didn't think I could do it. It just wasn't in me. And he thought this was hilarious because he said, but you spend your whole living speaking. But my point was, my speaking experience has always been as the role of an instructor. So it's always been to small groups, and I was the subject matter expert speaking to an invested audience. They wanted to know what I knew. Whereas what he was asking for is to go and stand up in front of hundreds of people and speak about something that I knew about and just hope that at some level it resonated with them. And that just the whole thought of putting that together just petrified me. But that same week, I actually had three people ask me the same question. They'd listened to that investing podcast and said, oh, well, you know, can you come and speak to my group? Largely they were IT people, but I told my wife about it, thinking, you know, this is just stupid, and I wanted her to back me up, and she totally didn't. She just said that maybe if all these people were ringing me, that maybe it's something that I should at least explore the possibility of. So I guess I've long advised people that when it comes to self-development, maybe the thing that you fear doing the most is possibly the thing you need to do first. So I found my way to not my nearest Toastmasters club. I did quite a bit of research, and I just found the biggest Toastmasters club I could find that was in a reasonable driving distance, because I figured if I joined a small club, then maybe, you know, that's a bit like having a conversation, speaking to small groups of people. It was what I already did. I needed to take myself way outside of my comfort zone and speak in front of a larger group. So I tried to find the biggest club I could that was around.
I understand that your experience as a pilot did not help you speak in front of large groups, but in what ways has your experience as a pilot prepared you for other types of public speaking?
Communications is the glue, I guess, that ties together all of the core competencies that it takes to be a good pilot. You know, it's all that teamwork, leadership, workload management, all comes down to communication. So I guess possibly, and I do explore some of these things in our podcast, maybe that we call it communicating with intent, basically figuring out what the message is that you want to get across, figuring out how you're going to do that before you open your mouth or before we press the transmit button in our case. I guess in that respect, like making sure I was getting my messages across, I'd spent quite some, you know, knowing the importance of framing a message, I guess I would say.
Can you walk us through a time where perhaps you had to communicate some crucial information to the passengers or crew, and how'd you handle it?
A lot of what we do on the flight deck in the core competencies that we use, we develop tools. So I guess we do actually use quite a few tools. I think I've spoken about a couple of these in the podcast. For example, we have a tool for having difficult conversations. We call it RAISE. It's basically how to help people who aren't maybe the most direct of communicators to communicate rather directly in their times of need. And then mm-hmm. we have another tool that we use called NITS that we use when we need to put across important information of what needs to happen in an emergency situation, what we require from other people. And we use this largely to communicate between the flight deck and the cabin, but we can also use it talking to air traffic control, people like that. So I guess over time, we put in place protocols for how we'll communicate that we can lean on when we do need to communicate.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned RAISE and NITS. Are mm-hmm. those acronyms?
Yeah. RAISE is an acronym. It means relaying information. It's asking questions, indicating concern, offering solutions, and then emergency language. So they're basically different levels of communicating something directly. So if you see something that's going on, then you would jump in at some level of RAISE to try and get someone's attention. The lowest level, I guess, would be the relaying information is just, I tell you what I'm seeing. Then they'd be asking questions, be basically asking you if you're seeing what I'm seeing, indicating concern, like I'm worried about what I'm seeing, offering solutions. Because I'm worried about what I'm seeing. I think maybe you should do this. And then, of course, then there's the emergency language. You say, you know, Greg, you must listen, or Greg, do this now. It's just a tool that we use to communicate directly, because not everyone's a direct communicator. I think a lot of pilots are, but not everybody is. And our NITS acronym is for just the nature of what you're trying to get across, your intentions, what time's available, and any special considerations. So they're just little protocols that we use to communicate in an emergency or if we need to have critical communications going across. But overlaying that, we also have other tools, which is, as I mentioned, the communicating with intent, which is to just to sit back before you communicate and ask, well, what is the message I want to get across here and how am I going to relay that before actually saying anything at all?
Mm-hmm. We don't always think about that. When we think about preparing for a flight or things during a flight, we're typically thinking about the procedures, you know, turning on the ignition, making sure the doors are locked, making sure the landing gear, et cetera, et cetera. You don't necessarily think about the communication side of things.
We talk about it a lot because it really is the glue that holds everything together. If it's really interesting with the way that aviation training is going now. We've moved to a model called evidence-based training where they've identified 9 core competencies that they feel every good pilot should have. And if you get a whole stack of pilots in a room, and which they've done, and say, well, what do you think makes a really good pilot? What do you think makes a great captain? What do you think makes a great team member? Then you'll find that you may actually not have stick and rudder skills hitting the list. It'll be all these other skills about knowledge, teamwork, leadership, situational awareness, workload management, and you'll get this whole laundry list of skills and behaviors that people see. And very rarely do they sit there and go, oh, the person needs to be absolutely top gun pilot. It's just, I think that's a given that you know how to fly. It's all the other stuff. But what seems to override it all is communications just ties all of that together. You know, you can't have teamwork and leadership and workload management and situational awareness without communicating, especially working in a team where there needs to be a shared mental model. Everything ties back to communication. It's, we spend a lot of time talking about it in the training field.
Are there any other lessons perhaps that you can share from the world of aviation that we as mere mortals on the ground, that it can fit into our everyday lives?
The messages from, for example, if I have a look through what episodes we've done before on the podcast, very early on, I did one on decision making about Sully with the Miracle on the Hudson, where we talk about the importance of going through a decision making process. You rarely need to make a decision without having time to think about it. We did an episode on automation management. We use a lot of automation on the flight deck now, and with all the talk of AI, I guess, of late. We did an episode on some of the best practices around the use of automation. I've had other episodes on using checklists, the power of knowledge, deliberate practice, improvement through incremental change. We did one on the best way to elicit help or to evacuate a building, how to recover from startle and shock, and how to learn from our mistakes. So there's a lot of things that we do on the flight deck that are equally relevant to any field of life, I guess.
Wow. It's funny, I digress for a second, is when I first listened to your podcast, you mentioned about Sully Sullenberg and I think Airways flight, what was it, 1459? That was the first thing that popped into my head as soon as I started listening to your podcast.
The whole story of the podcast relates back to Sully and the Miracle on the Hudson, actually. Yeah.
Before we get to that, there's a couple of things that I'm curious about. I'm just wondering, can you think of perhaps one pilot training tool or mindset that you think that every professional could benefit from?
I could give you two that I think are just super important. I'd choose from either the importance of knowledge or the power of incremental change. So for me, knowledge is important. Knowledge gives us options, and knowledge enables us to be better at what we do, whatever it is. Knowledge of whatever it is that you want to be better at will make you better at that thing. As for the power of incremental change, I think that we're all inclined to overestimate the importance of making big changes in our lives, but underestimate the value of making many smaller but consistently better decisions as we go along. I think it's easy to forget that all of our habits, good or bad, and all the things we do, good or bad, are the result of all the tiny little better or worse decisions we make along the way. So I've actually done 2 entire episodes on these 2 points because I think they're really important. It's like, you know, having a good fundamental knowledge of whatever it is that you want to be good at and and just constantly chipping away at making yourself better at that by making tiny little changes.
And of course, decision making when you're 30,000 feet in the air could make the difference of life or death. You got to be focused on what you're thinking and the decisions you're going to make.
Yeah, I think that one thing about decision making is if there's something that I've learned from, I guess, over 35 years as a professional aviator, is that there's very rarely a time that you don't have time to go through at least some sort of decision making process. And when there isn't, then there's usually someone's put in place a protocol to deal with that. I like using the example of a first aider coming across an unconscious person, and obviously getting oxygen to their brain and everything like that is super important. You don't have time to sit there and go and figure out things from first principles, and therefore someone's come up with the Dr. ABC protocol. And I sit there on the flight deck for us, there to be, if you have an engine failure on the takeoff run and you have to abort the takeoff, then they don't want us making a decision about that. They have a protocol that we just launch straight into, a memory item. So the thinking is outside of that. But then when you come and look at something like Sully, you think they had like less than 3 minutes from when they hit those birds to landing on the Hudson. There were no checklists in place for that. But if you, and I did actually do this in a Toastmaster speech, just have a look at it in real time, you can see that there is a definite decision-making process in play. You just didn't come up with that decision to land in the Hudson on the spot. That was a decision that was made over 3 minutes. So I think that that's one big lesson about decision-making, I think, is that there's very, very rarely ever a time that you have to make a decision where you can't at least go through some rudimentary decision-making process.
You're mentioning this, and I'm thinking about, you mentioned in one of your episodes, it might have been the episode called Like a Pilot or Breathe Like a Pilot, where you were talking about a plane where the autopilot disengaged and the knee-jerk reaction actually caused a few people to not make it.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, there's been a few. We did a couple of episodes like that. There's obviously the one on automation with Air France 447. But, yes, I know the one that you're talking about, and I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head, but, yeah, an episode on in fact, it has a lot in common with, do you remember you did an episode on your podcast with the psychologist from New Zealand?
Yes, yes.
And she was talking about breathing there, and it's really interesting because it's something that we actually teach in the simulator for recovering from surprise and startle. First of all is we run through a protocol. We call it recognize, confirm. It basically entails like recognizing the situation you're in. So you take account of where you think things are at, what's going on, but then confirming that you are what you're thinking is happening is what you're actually seeing. But then, and I think this came through on your podcast as well, is like there needs to be some mechanism to re-engage your upper thought processes and overcome that fight, flight type response. And one of the really easy ways to do this is just to take a breath. It actually has a physiological effect where you re-engage your upper thought processes, and it lets you make a considered response rather than to just react instinctively, which may be the wrong thing to do in the cases you're saying where guys have just reacted to what they think they're seeing and it's ended in disaster.
Mm. Actually, I just looked up that episode. I think it's Stage Fright, A Psychologist's Perspective with Dr. Kristen Hamling.
Yeah, I've listened to that one a couple of times. I think I've got that saved on my iPhone. It's a fantastic episode for anyone who hasn't listened to it.
Ironically, we published it almost 4 years ago. It was April 1st, 2021. It's episode 178, and I'll definitely make reference to that in the show notes. Before we go into the podcast, I just wanted to ask, I neglected to ask, when you were talking about overcoming that fear in front of the large group, how did you ultimately overcome that fear?
Again, it's interesting because that comes back to exactly what we're just talking about, that exact same episode that you're talking about. I mentioned before, when it comes to self-development, I think that the thing that you fear doing the most is possibly the thing you need to start with. So when we're talking about that episode that you did with the psychologist, I think she talked a bit about desensitization through exposure. It's exactly the same thing. The only way that I was going to get over that fear of speaking in front of a large group of people was to actually do it. So I guess I joined a really big club I started taking meeting roles. Sometimes, you know, I still needed a nudge there. When I was seeing people that had joined after me taking on the Toastmasters role really early on in their journey, I'm going, well, why haven't I done that yet? So that really prompted me. One of the guys in my club, James, he joined after me, but I usually find once he's done General Evaluator, I'll do that. Once he was Toastmaster, I'll do that. I usually find, well, if James has done it, maybe I should do it now. I put my name down to speak at a joint club meeting, which actually led to a speech about decision-making about the Miracle on Hudson. And from that, I was invited to present at a district training event. And then eventually one of the DTMs, our club's lucky, we've got three DTMs at our club. In fact, we've got, I think, two or three people that have had 30-plus years in Toastmasters at our club. But anyway, there's a depth of experience there. And one of them arranged for me to speak to an audience of 80 to 100 people outside of the club.
Nice.
They bought me lunch and asked me to stay for coffee, so I assume it went okay. But
that's a good thing.
I think that's when I realized, I think I'm over this fear of speaking in public now, because I went along to that. I gave the speech. It was on something I wanted to speak about. It seemed to resonate with the crowd, and I really enjoyed it. I actually really, really enjoyed it. And I thought, okay, tick that box of being able to speak in front of large crowds now, because it wasn't an issue. And I thought, wow, okay, that's progress.
For those of you who may not be familiar with the story about Sully Sullenberger, there's a movie called Miracle on the Hudson that featured Tom Hanks. And Phil, you had mentioned earlier that there's also some documentaries as well.
Yeah, for sure. That's where the whole podcasting came about. And so many of these things, these opportunities where I've had to speak in front of a large group. We had a joint meeting with Q, another club that's down the road from us, also a rather large club. And I was doing level 3 in presentation mastery, and there was a storytelling project. So I decided to wheel out a story about Sully and the Miracle on the Hudson, so US Airways 1549, at that meeting. But I framed it around something that had actually happened to me during the pandemic, when, like every pilot in the world, we were presented with the opportunity to seek different employment arrangements, i.e. we were stood down. So I took up a role in the Victorian Public Service. That's a state that I live in Australia. And I worked in a management role in our government's response to COVID. And I brought the story back to, while I was there, one of my colleagues had said to me, and it comes back to what you were saying about decision-making before in the chat that we had, but one of my colleagues just said to me once about one of the other managers, he said, hey, you know, I just love the way that Pete makes decisions. He doesn't even stop to think. He's just off the hip, boom, 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 decision, decision, decision. And I turned around to him and I said, you say that like it's a good thing. And his response to me was, you say it like it isn't. And I said to her exactly what I said before. I think there's the one thing I've learned in over 35 years as a professional aviator is that there's almost zero circumstances under which there's not time to undergo some form of a decision-making process. And where there isn't, someone will have made a protocol for it. And as I said, I use the Dr. ABC for first aiders as an example. Just to rehash on that, you know, the Miracle on the Hudson, they were taking off out of LaGuardia and very close to the ground, hit a flock of birds that basically meant both engines were catastrophically damaged. They were never going to get them back. They didn't really know that at the time. They just went through their processes to try and restart the engines. And the whole thing from hitting the birds to ditching took less than 3 minutes. But in my speech, in real time, we had a look at that there's still a decision-making process there. And I introduced one decision-making model that we use at work. It's called GRADE. It's basically gathering information, reviewing that information with the view to generating options, analyzing those, so coming up with doing a risk analysis of which one's going to be the best path to begin with, basically deciding, implementing it, and then evaluating how that's gone and constantly changing. And you can see all of those steps in Sully's process. His initial reaction wasn't to land in the Hudson. He generated options of a number of different airfields, and you could see that as more information came to hand that they weren't going to be able to restart the engines, that they were losing height faster than what maybe they'd initially thought, that that it moved towards landing in the Hudson. And you can see even that evaluation right down to the very last point, he was still reevaluating his decision, where I think he turned to his first officer just before they actually landed in the water and asked him whether he had any other ideas. And the answer was priceless. He just said, actually, no. and that's where they did. But when I gave that speech at Q, I noticed that people were taking photos of my slide pack. And later on, they were asking me a lot of questions about it. I fielded a lot of questions that night. And I guess that's actually where the invitation then came to speak at the district training event I mentioned. I was asked to give a speech on conflict resolution. And I really struggled to actually think of a time where I'd seen real, because I think of conflict as people yelling at each other, screaming, maybe violence. And I thought, I couldn't actually think of a time that this had happened. I end up instead speaking about another flight deck tool. That was the RAISE one that we talked about earlier, for having difficult conversations and communicating directly. And I guess that's where the whole idea of the podcast originated, that realizing that there were many, many more of these core competencies that pilots continually work on and refine, building tools and processes, but they're robust enough to be transferable, specifically those things I mentioned: communication, leadership, teamwork, problem solving, decision making, I guess risk analysis, situational awareness, workload management, those sorts of core competencies. By the way, the difficult conversations, the decision making speeches, as I mentioned, both found their way into our first two podcast episodes. Actually, Greg, I somewhat have you to blame for the podcast.
Oh, no.
Do you remember your 200th episode in 2022?
200th episode. Oh, right. The podcast. We had a podcast contest.
Pitch us your podcast idea contest.
Yes, I remember that. That was great.
Yeah. So now I'm a bit of a podcast junkie, but at the time, the Toastmasters podcast was actually the first podcast I'd ever really listened to. In fact, the first time I appeared on a podcast was before I even knew what a podcast was. That was Ross Bentley, the guy I wrote my book with, interviewed me for his Speed Secrets podcast. Fast forward to level 4, presentation mastery, I see this podcast elective, but your 200th episode had piqued my interest, and I thought, hey, why not give this podcasting thing a go? And that actually is what led to the article that you talked about as well, because that interest that had come from your podcast, because that interest had come from your podcast, I just flicked the thank you email, thanks for the inspiration, aiming to get it to you, but the email was addressed to the magazine who ran the contest with you, and they got in contact and asked me if I could write an article.
Wow, that's awesome.
So there you go. It's all your fault.
It's all my fault. We had a very good response to the podcast contest. We had a lot of entries. We had a lot of people inspired to start their own podcasts, do the level 4s. Podcasting is a great public relations tool. That's great. I'm certainly glad you did it. I'm enjoying your podcast. I'm thoroughly enjoying it. Tell us a little bit about your book. Is it primarily for aviators, or is that also for anybody?
Oh, yes. It's very niche. So some background. I used to race cars. And as I mentioned, the podcast I went on for Ross Bentley, he's an ex-IndyCar driver. He's had a series of books called Speed Secrets, and he's also a performance coach, both predominantly inside motor racing, but also outside. And one of the books that he wrote was on the mental side of racing. I was reading this, and I really couldn't put it down, but not from a driver's perspective. I was reading this book thinking, I wish that I had had this book on my Air Force pilots course. It would have made so much of a difference to me. I ended up talking to another friend of mine from within racing, George, and I said, you know, someone should write a book like this for pilots. I guess the short story is he said, well, you're somebody. Why don't you contact Ross? And it just was one of those weird situations where everything fell into place. I got in contact with Ross about my idea for a book for pilots, and he'd just come back from lecturing to the United States Air Force on exactly these sorts of principles. He'd also done a little bit of helicopter flying himself, so he was dead keen on the idea. So he said, oh, yeah, right, yeah, this is a great idea. Let's write a book for pilots. That was the easy bit. 5 years later and a lot of research, then Performance Pilot was born. I guess in a nutshell, it's the book I wish I had when I'd started learning to fly. If I was to give an elevator pitch to other pilots, it's basically a performance coaching book, or uses performance coaching strategies for pilots to help speed up their training progress, prepare and practice more effectively, things like overcoming test anxiety so they can perform better on flight tests and improve their flying skills. So to go back to your original question, yes, very niche, very much a pilot's only book, this one.
Well, we might have some pilots or aspiring pilots in our listener audience, so we'll certainly include that in the show notes. Well, folks, if you've been inspired by our flight today, I encourage you to share this episode with your family and friends and fellow Toastmasters. You can get the Toastmasters podcast at toastmasterspodcast.com, toastmasters.org, Apple, Spotify, and anywhere you get your podcasts. Well, Phil, this has been one incredibly pleasant flight, or perhaps a great flight simulation. If you could let folks know if they want to reach out to you to find out more about your podcast, find out more about your book, or just want to touch base with you, what's the best way for them to do that?
Okay, yeah, it's been great talking to you, Greg. If people want to take a listen to the Like a Pilot podcast, it's at all the usual places, Spotify, Apple, YouTube, everywhere where you listen to your favorite podcasts, as they say. Any pilots who want to check out the Performance Pilot book, it's available on Amazon and wherever you get your great flying books. We've got our own website there, performancepilot.net. Or if people want to get in touch with me specifically, there's links on my website at philwilks.com, or I'm on LinkedIn and I've got an author's page on Facebook. So there's a few avenues there.
Phil Wilks, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. It's been an absolute pleasure, and all the best for your next flight.
Thanks, Greg. A pleasure speaking to you also.